For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so we are in 1 Corinthians, and if you've been with us for the last few weeks, you know that Paul is not afraid to get into the real tough issues of life. And actually, in chapters 5 through 7, we've been studying Paul's discussion of sexuality. And as it turns out, the Corinthian culture was pretty broken on this point and pretty parasitic, and prostitution and just all kinds of things characterized this society. They were really turned sideways on just what even is the purpose of sexuality. And so Paul, in chapter 6 especially, just really walks through what does it mean to have a sexual identity, and what is the relationship between ourselves as sexual beings and morality. Is sexuality even in the realm of morality? And which is a pretty, I think, important conversation for our culture, because we're confused on that point as well. We talked about the relationship between our sexuality and our spirituality, the question of the relationship between the spirit and the body. And then we talked also, as Paul does, about whether there's a connection between our intimate life within the household and the broader community of which we're a part. And is there such a thing really as just, you know, a victimless crime or relationship between two that has no effect on anyone else? And Paul argues, and it's pretty clear from sociological studies even today, that our private lives have a dynamic effect on all of our personal relationships outside the family. Anyway, that's some of the foundation that Paul is laying out. And there are, of course, some CDs if you want to pick up information from a couple weeks ago. Pick up on that, lay that foundation work. We talked then about some of the real sensitive issues that Paul had to address in his culture that we really have to look at in ours as well. The question of developing a healthy sexual relationship in marriage. And why that's a value, why that's important, and it is important. And then we talked about, as Paul goes into chapter 7 there, about divorce and about living single and what that's about. And now we come to the last of these really difficult things, which is sensitive talk about a spiritually divided marriage. And this is, I think, an especially difficult topic for Paul's audience, because there were people in this group. This is a church that's only been around for, you know, a decade or less, actually. And Paul is writing people. In some cases, a husband has come to faith in Christ and is starting to put the pieces of their spiritual life together, but they're married to a woman who is not a believer. And the reverse also being the case, where you have people who are women coming to Christ are married to men who are not. And there are all these tensions then about, well, what do we do in a situation where we're just not reading off the same page at all? That's a big deal, because the Bible describes, and Paul lays out this idea, that marriage is the union of two people to share one life. The two shall become one flesh. That's the definition of marriage given all the way back in the book of Genesis chapter 2. And so there's this union that is physical. It is a union that is emotional and psychological, but it is also deeply a connection on a spiritual level between spiritual people. And this is where the problem was being had for these Corinthians, you know, to have a shared life and a spiritual life where we are able to nurture one another in our spiritual relationship with God. That's part of God's design for marriage and the kind of partnership that he desires for us to have. To be able to, you know, we'll have people coming in and out of our life for the whole of our life as married people. But there's only one person who has said to us, till death do I part. Right? That's the person that you marry. And so there's a lot at stake in the spiritual dimensions of that relationship in terms of our ability to catalyze one another's faith, to move forward, to be united in one purpose for life. And Paul now is dealing with this problem, and many of us also are dealing with this problem where that dynamic isn't there. And so we're not necessarily reading off the same page at all about what do we value, what are we about, what do we want to accomplish in life, what is the nature of our spiritual relationship. And this creates some chaos. It cultivates, in some cases, some real resentments. And so the faith of one spouse is actually offending the faith of the other, and so forth. And so where do we go with that? What do we do with that? And I think you'll find Paul's counsel on this issue to be both relevant to us and extremely interesting. Let's take a look. He says, starting in verse 12, I speak to the rest of you. Now he's been talking about, okay, if you're single, let's talk about that. If you're married, let's talk about that. If you're divorced, let's talk about that. And so he's just kind of singled out, you know, a lot of the people that make up this group. And so now he says, I speak to the rest of you, though, he says, I do not have a direct word from the Lord. If a brother in Christ has a wife who is not a believer and she is willing to continue living with him, he must not leave her. And likewise, if a believing woman has an unbelieving husband and she is willing to continue living with her, she should not leave him. Interesting. Notice the language here. He says, now I'll speak to the rest of you, though I do not have a direct word from the Lord. There's a humility about Paul's counsel here that's very important. You know, he's the big banana in the church. He's the apostle. He is a person through whom God has spoken directly, which is why his words are scripture. But he also is aware that there are areas in life for which God has not established an expressed will. And one of those circumstances has to do with the relationship of a non-Christian spouse to a Christian spouse. And so he says, what I'm going to give you is advice. And it's advice rooted in biblical principle. And I'm applying biblical principle, as we'll see in just a minute. But God has not spoken with any finality on this point, and so it becomes a matter of conscience. These are conscience issues that people have to wrestle out through individually before God. And I love that about Paul, that he's willing to just put it out there for what it is and keep the issue where it needs to be, which is my relationship with God and how am I living that out in my marriage relationship if I'm married to a person that I don't share that intimate spiritual bond with. So let's take a look at it. There are a couple of very important principles, actually one in each of the verses that follow, that I want to work out with this here this evening. He says in verse 14, now a reason's being given for why you should stand in there in that relationship. Don't walk away from your spouse just because she does not share that same relationship with God through Christ that you do. He says, Because the believing wife brings God's life into her marriage. And the believing husband brings God's life into his marriage. And without this, your children would not have this influence. And so there's a principle that Paul is very concerned about. It's the principle of influence here. And he's saying, if you have come to Christ, as many of us even here tonight have, while already being married, and your spouse isn't where you are spiritually at this point, he's saying, stand in there because why? Because you are an intimate influence on the life of your spouse and also on your children. So there's this principle of being an intimate ally. And no one is going to be able to speak with the kind of integrity and clarity to a person who's not put it all together in terms of where do they stand with God than the person that they're married to. It's a hugely important issue. And it gets to this point that there's real power in just the one. There's a lot of disappointment, I think, that comes in the lives of married people for lots of reasons. So I can pretty much guess that if you're here tonight and you're married, you struggle with a certain level of disappointment, right? And so you think, well, you know, gosh, if my spouse would just, yeah, that doesn't work. Or if we could just, well, that's a little bit better, but still it's not going to work. what God is saying is, well, how about if you would just? And that the initiating real love into the marriage relationship is what each one of us as individuals has the responsibility to do. And in fact, it is possible, and there are many of us, even here tonight, I know, who had extremely troubled marriages, very broken marriages. And the husband and the wife were not reading off the same page. They were not at the same place, spiritually or morally or on any other level. But that one person within the marriage says, I'm going to stand in there with God in this marriage. And so far as it depends upon me, I'm committed to its success. And a person who's willing to make that kind of a commitment, that kind of a stand in their marriage, is in a position to do way more good than they realize. That we have, as husbands and as wives, way more power in our marriage relationship than sometimes we might think that we do. And so, sort of capturing the power that's there, Paul's saying, you know, what you need to do is you need to be for your spouse. Okay, they're not where you are. There may be lots of reasons for why that's the case, but you need to be for her. You need to be for him, because that's the nature of that marriage relationship, and you don't want them to think that in the name of Christ that you would diminish that commitment of being for them. On the contrary, what they need to understand through the way that you live is that it is in your relationship with Christ that enables you actually to move toward them in ways that perhaps you were never able to do before. In a real analogous kind of circumstance, the Apostle Peter gives this kind of counsel. He says, this is 1 Peter 3, and he says, wives, and he's talking here about to wives whose husbands are not believing. He says, wives, accept the authority of your husbands. In other words, don't fight with them. Don't make it a steer wrestling thing. He says, then even if some refuse to obey the gospel, your godly lives will speak to them without even using words. He says, they will be won over when they observe your pure and respectful lives. Well, I got to win the argument, you say. Well, how about a different way? How about robbing the argument of its power by showing him respect and by moving toward him, by being concerned about his life? You may find, in fact, that his resistance to your faith is more rooted in the ego struggle you're having in the marriage than anything else. And that if you just are willing to stand back and without controlling the thing, just to get in there and show him respect, maybe he'll become interested, he'll become curious. And similarly, he says to the husband, give honor to your wife. She is an equal partner. Boy, in the first century context, that's amazing, because they were certainly not equal partners in any sense culturally, man and woman, in the context of marriage. A man owned his wife. She was chattel. She was property. And Paul here is saying something very revolutionary. He's saying, honor your wife and treat her for who she is. She's an equal partner. She has all the dignity that you have. She has all the abilities that you have. And your job, husbands, is not to condescend your wife, but to get under your wife, to work for her interests, to work for her good. And if you're willing to be for your spouse in this way, by being respectful, by laying down your life for them, then you are in a position to begin to influence. And that's really what he's saying here. Do you want to influence your spouse? Well, here's the way you do it. You get in there, like he's describing, and you make Christ visible to them. Okay, you are the day-to-day evidence of the reality of Christ in your marriage, is what he's saying. And as such, we want to be able to be like Christ, moving toward people in ways that effectively express love to them. Well, he just likes to sit around on his ever-expanding butt and watch TV, and I'm just not into that. Are you like too good for TV or what? I mean, what is it? Well, you know, he likes to take these trips, and I really am a homebody. I just like to stay at home. That's what I'm into. Well, maybe you ought to expand your horizons a little bit here. He just sits around and he listens to music all the time. Good for him. Maybe you should take a hankering to that music that he's into. See, find a way in their world, according to what makes them feel loved and cared for, and show love that way. You're breaking down barriers as you do that. You're showing them the graciousness of God to serve them sacrificially. And to just to say, look, you're worthy of the love of God, and I'm gonna show you that in just the way that I'm willing to move toward you without strings attached. You're not saying, well, I think my spouse is just there, you know, they are really together and they're just great and they just draw me in. Sometimes this is a kind of a difficult decision that you make. I'm making a decision, you know, my spouse is, you know, they're very argumentative. They're really hard to love. They keep pushing me away. Well, okay, then put on your football helmet and move in there. And be gracious and be sacrificial. And above all, be the first to admit when you're wrong. If you want to draw near to somebody, and you want to be at a place where you are able to influence them in areas that really matter, then you better show humility. You better make sure that they had no sense whatsoever that you are condescending to them, that somehow you are holier than thou, that you're now better than they are because, you know, you're into this God thing and they're not into this God thing. The person who really understands the grace and the love and the mercy of God through Christ is going to be the first person to say, man, I've been thinking about our marriage. And I've been thinking about the kind of patterns that I have fallen into over the years. And I realized at a certain point, man, I would hate to be married to me. Will you forgive me? For failing to love in a way that I've come to understand God's love really is. And, you know, when a person hears that from their spouse, it's like, you know, it really thaws that iceberg out. I mean, that could be a great cause for global warming right there, is if Christian spouses would just come along their non-Christian spouse and just have that kind of open transparency and just to admit, I do not love in the way that Christ has loved me. I have not learned how to do that in your life. And I'm just asking, will you forgive me for that? Well, you know, it's really hard to argue with that. And it's very attractive, too, because it's just this humility that breaks down the ego, the pride, the standoffs that so typify the marriage relationship. And so that's what an intimate ally does. Now, Paul also, in verse 14, includes a concern for the children, and I think that that's an issue as well. Namely, that you want to stay in that relationship within the moral framework of Scripture. We talked about divorce, and there are legitimate grounds for divorce that we talked about last time. I don't want to review that, but I do want to say with Paul that there's a reason to stay in marriage to have that kind of influence on children, especially when they're young, where they're forming their basic spiritual categories, and as they age, as they see you as a Christian in a difficult marriage relationship, how you behave, how you're prepared to move toward that spouse really teaches them a lot about grace and teaches them a lot about forgiveness and mercy and reconciliation. These are life skills that they're going to need if at some time in their future they choose to marry someone as imperfect as you. So they're going to need that training. And as someone who's got their resources, because we've met Christ and we've received His forgiveness, to be able to demonstrate that forgiveness in the intimate relationships that are hard, you know, that is how we instruct our children. That's the life skills that we are giving to them. So it's really important. And then lastly, along these lines, I think that there's an important principle here of keeping Christ first. Notice the language that Paul uses in verse 14. He says, now if they want to stay with you, then don't send them away. But that presumes, you know, that Christ has in some ways introduced a different kind of tension in that relationship. And in part, it's because now we're recognizing a new affection in our own hearts as we want to respond to God. We want to be involved in the things of God. And as we do that, here's the thing, we're going to feel a certain amount of tension at home over time, over other kinds of values, decisions that we, because we're following Christ, we're learning a new way of living, that's going to have practical outworking and a certain amount of tension on the home front. We're going to be real tempted to ease that tension by just not going God's way, maybe in important areas of our life. Maybe our husband is like, you know, or our wife is saying, you know, I just need you around me all the time. You can't go hang out with your Christian buddies because, well, then I would just melt. You know, I couldn't handle you being gone for the evening or whatever it is. And so you're like, oh, okay, you know, and so you don't go. But the problem is then that you begin to starve spiritually yourself. And there's a lesson that if you take an airplane flight, you will learn. And which is what they always tell you before the takeoff is that in the event of emergency, you have to put on your oxygen mask first before you help somebody else. Remember that? You know, the little thing comes down. You know, if you're there with a child or somebody who's dependent, your first impulse is, I want to help them, right? And what they're trying to say is if you want to be helpful, then you better have that oxygen going to yourself. Or you're not going to have the resources to be able to help them. And so even though it is sometimes difficult in the home, if we're not reading off the same page spiritually, we're going to have to make decisions that our spouse may take exception with, maybe make us pay in some ways, withhold love or become angry or whatever. But we're going to have to find a place, and maybe we'll need to be creative about it, where that flow of spiritual life is continuing to nurture us and to build us up, enabling us then to be at a place where we can consistently give the love of Christ away. And I just know, having been involved in this kind of community for a number of decades now, that when we have those tensions at home over Christ, there is that tendency for a believing spouse to withdraw from the contexts that they really need to be healthy, and as a consequence, that it doesn't help the marriage at all. And so we need to be able to breathe in that oxygen if we're going to be able to be a benefit to somebody else. It's an extremely important point. Here's the second principle right here. Verse 15. If the husband or the wife who isn't a believer insists on leaving, let him go. The believing husband or wife is no longer bound to the other. You know, if they want out, okay. He says, and there's a principle then. He says, for God has called you to peace. So peace is the second principle that he is appealing to right here. There's value to that. And that God calls on His people to be peacemakers at home. Let's think about that for a minute. There is a thing we could call pseudo-peace. It's the Neville Chamberlain peace. Peace at any price. It's the idea that a peace as appeasement. In other words, I'll try to limit the things that irritate you so that you don't get angry. instead of saying, we got a problem here, namely that you're angry all the time or whatever, you're always depressed, you're mopey or whatever, we're always trying to scuttle around and make them feel better and wearing ourselves out, always trying to distance them from the consequences of their failed way of living. And that is not peace, that's appeasement. You're not helping them in any way. You're just furthering their commitment to their own ill health spiritually, emotionally, psychologically, socially, and on other levels. That's not peace. Peace is not giving people what they want. Peace is not making people feel better for a moment. Peace is a much deeper concept. And bringing Christ into the picture makes peace in some ways more difficult. And Jesus was a controversialist. If you follow in the Gospels the life of Christ, it's not like he went from place to place and he had all these conversations and everyone's like, oh, Jesus, we are so glad to see you. Oh, Jesus, what you have to say is so awesome and so profound. I just want to believe it. Now, most people rejected him, and so that at the end of his time on the earth, he's alone, rejected by everyone, even his closest associates. Jesus is a controversialist, and he will introduce, for the sake of our good, controversy into all of our relationships, including our marriages. And just being about the things of Christ, being about Christ, can be very threatening to our spouse. Spouses who have not yet met Christ as we have, who maybe come from a religious background that has really turned them off, and now you are really getting into Jesus, and they're thinking, oh, God, I thought that, I thought we were safe from that. But no. It's back, you know, and so what now? You know, are we going to be having Kool-Aid or, you know, what is it that, what should I expect here? And this whole idea of Christianity, very threatening. And I walked away from that at 13 and I have no interest whatsoever in going back. And so there's a threat there. There's a threat to my ego. Because, you know, I don't really, you know, feel that I want to yield to God at all. Because why? Well, because I want to be my own deity. I want to be the one who's the master of my own domain, the controller of my destiny. And God for me is really a threat. Or maybe it's the self-righteous person who says, I am totally cool with God because I'm so cool. I'm so good, and implicitly what you're doing by your faith is you're judging me. And you're saying, no, you're not good enough on your own. Well, that's not really what I'm saying, but that is true. That is true. That self-righteous people are not acceptable to God. People who recognize their need for forgiveness, God eagerly seeks. But Christ is going to be a controversy in your marriage. And you just have to recognize that that is going to be the case. And ask yourself, why is my spouse really threatened by Christ? There are answers to that. There may be real conflicts and values in your marriage. You may be aspiring for different things. One spouse may be saying, you know, we have the capacity to earn about $250,000 a year. And here you're saying you're not really into that anymore. And that really messes with my game plan. I was thinking retirement at 45 as a millionaire, and you're cramping my style. We got problems here. My aspirations, your aspirations, that you want to move away into, this 40 acres out in the middle of nowhere. So why? So you can just be left alone. And the other one's saying, well, you know, actually God's called us to people, and far from moving away from people to the middle of nowhere, I want to move more toward people. And so we got those kind of real tensions going on. We got parenting priorities. Man, do we have conflicts about this in our culture. We've got parents with nothing really going on in their own lives, so they're wanting to live vicariously through their children. We've got parents who define effective parenting as the child who has everything, the child who performs better than anyone, and we're going to ramp them up and do whatever we can to put them in that place where they can succeed. And the believing spouse is like, well, I want them to succeed too, but I think success looks a lot different than what you're talking about here. We got a difference of opinion that's not minor. It's a real difference. And so we need to think about peace as the Bible describes it in the reality of these kinds of conflicts. The Bible uses a word from the Old Testament called shalom. It's the peace of God. It is a peace that is based upon truth and honesty. It's not peace at any price. It is the experience of peace in relationship because we have subordinated our thinking and how we relate and what we're about to God. And so for that reason, our conflicts between one another are resolved. We experience His peace because we're choosing to go His way. And that is the ideal in the context of marriage. And what it means then, in marriage, and we don't have to have the kind of spiritually divided relationship that Paul is describing here. We can just be, well, our own marriages can reflect this as well. That we can be seriously divided on things and we're going to need to know when to take a stand. When accommodating a certain way of living or a direction in life is dangerous, it's not someplace that within my own conscience I feel that I should be going at all, and I'm going to have to take a stand here. Now, some of us are people who like to make mountains out of molehills. Others of us like to make molehills out of mountains, right? And so we need to think for a little bit here, just for in the sense of what principles do we bring to bear? When are we willing to introduce real conflict, real tension in our marriage for the sake of going through a process that might actually bring this peace of God, this honest, truthful peace that God offers to us? We need to ask ourselves, if I'm in a conflict with my spouse and it's an issue, I need to ask myself, what's at stake here? What's at stake? Is it, well, you know, they want to paint the living room yellow for God's sake. And that's just not acceptable to me. I mean, I would rather die than live in a yellow living room. I would rather be divorced than have to live in a yellow living room. Well, we say of someone like that, come on, man, really? Get a life. That's lame. On the other hand, if we're saying, well, your desire is to invest and to go into debt and to basically be at that place that forces us both to work massive hours, just like our neighbors seem like they've kind of adopted that way, you know. And so it's we should both be working our 60 hours a week, and we should both be earning as much money as possible. And you're saying to yourself, well, I know that our neighbors do that, but man, I don't want to be in my life where they are. I think God's got a better way. I know He does. I know that He considers wealth to be the richness of the relationships that we have and our ability to be used by Him. No, I'm not going to go along with that agenda. Or we may say, you know, okay, one spouse is saying what we really need to do is put our high schooler into every conceivable club and all sports and all accelerated classes all the time. Why? So that they can be a beautiful reflection of my parenting. Well, we wouldn't say that, of course. We say, we've got to keep them busy or they're going to get into drugs or whatever it might be. Or they're going to be competing with their neighbor, and we as good parents, we've got to give them this edge. Well, we're going to fight this out. But a believing spouse is going to say, now, hang on a second. I mean, I don't want Johnny to be dumb, and I'm committed to Johnny's education and everything else. But what I really want him to do is to learn what it means to be a part of a community of people, to learn how to sacrifice, to learn how to practice grace, to learn how to live for something that means something besides themselves. And so, no, I'm not for this. And so if we're going to be in conflict, let's at least be in conflicted about something that matters. You've got to say, okay, what really is at stake here? What's at stake? And also, where do we agree? And here, I think we fail often at this point because we're more palpably aware of where we disagree, right? But it's really hard to resolve big problems and to find truthful peace if all we're focusing in on is where we're disagreeing with one another. And it's important that we're able to say, you know, it is important that we provide for our children. I agree with that. And it is important that our children know how to live in this world, and we agree on that. And that we want them to be balanced people. We agree with that. And we're just going at it. We're just trying to say we are allies here. We're not adversaries. We need to find places where we can really agree so that we're able to find out where we really differ, and more importantly, why. Namely, what is the principle at stake here? Is the principle that you offend me? Is the principle that this is inconvenient? Is the principle I just don't want to do that? Or is there something much more important at stake? You know, a real understanding of what's good for our children, or what's important for our marriage, or what's healthy for me as a growing Christian. You know, we have to understand why we differ, not just that we differ. And then we need to ask ourselves a difficult question. How am I serving by the stand that I'm taking? How is my position here an act of service rather than something that is really, you know, very self-invested, and it's all about me and it's for me? And ultimately then, who do I answer to for the stand that I take? And someone who's really got their head on spiritually is going to say what matters is not whether my spouse and I agree or if things go my way, but that the important decisions of life are decisions that glorify God, that are decisions that He is calling me to. I need to be a person of conviction, and my convictions need to be along the lines of pleasing my Lord. See, that is the issue. So if we are thinking along those lines, it seems to me, and I know that this is true from experience, my marriage has not always been great. And because why? Because I'm a pretty crappy husband in a lot of ways. And we have tension over significant issues. And these are the kinds of things that we have looked to over the years to come together and to make, though we are different people, important decisions for the sake of real unity in our marriage. And we've got to be able to walk through these kinds of processes together. And then lastly, okay, so there is the desire to serve our spouse, to be an intimate ally. There is the need to work for real peace in that relationship and to be advocates for peace as long as our spouse will be willing to stay in there with us on that. And then finally, in verse 16, he says, don't you wives realize that your husbands might be saved because of your influence? And don't you husbands realize that your wives might be saved because of your influence? Well, in some ways, what Paul is doing here is he's really raising the stakes. He's not saying that a person, your spouse's eternal destiny, is rooted in decisions that you make. He's not saying that. He's talking here about influence. And he's talking about being intentional in the marriage relationship. The marriage relationship above all, but certainly including the relationship with our children, with our extended family, and then on out from there, are relationships that are deeply connected with the good news of the gospel. And in that sense, there is always in our intimate relationships a gospel motivation. I know that I don't have the resources to meet my spouse's needs. I simply don't. But I can be one who directs her to the one who does. And so just at the very foundation of all of our relationships, it comes back to that same motivation. Paul says, this is 2 Corinthians chapter 5. He puts it like this. I'm kind of stringing it together because it's the whole package is kind of summed up like this. He says, knowing the awe of God, having experienced God, having met God in a real way, he says, we persuade other people. Christians are, by virtue of their faith, persuaders. He says, the love of Christ urges us on. It's just like, that's the natural thing. If you know God, if you've experienced him, it has a natural effect of moving you toward others. And God, he says, reconciled us to himself and gave us the message of reconciliation. We speak for Christ when we plead, come back to God. For God made Christ, who never sinned, to be our offering for sin so that we could be made right with God through Christ. And so there is this real need in our marriage relationship if our spouse has not yet come to know God through Christ. We want to make it easy for them by breaking down the barriers that put us in the way. That's a lot of what we've been talking about up to this point. But we also then need to be positive and forthright and to say, you know, you are alienated from God. I love you. I've committed my life to you, but you are alienated from God. And as such, where I'm heading forever and where you're heading forever are not the same place. And I want to spend forever with you. But that means that you have a decision to make to free yourself of your guilt before God that brings you under his judgment. And this is what Paul is saying. Christ, who did not sin, became our offering for sin so that we could be made right with God. And that is a decision you must make. Look, you know me. I'm no saint, and I've approached you, and I've asked you, forgive me for the fact that I've really become aware of how sinful I am in our marriage, and you know too, that you're not right inside, and that you are far from God. And God has moved toward you, and God has dealt with that problem. And he is calling on you through me. That's what Paul is saying here. He urges us, come back to God through our spouse, through those close relationships. He's calling out to us, and he's saying, oh, come back. All I'm asking you to do is don't turn your back to me, but turn your face to me. I'm just asking you, will you please receive the gift of reconciliation with God, of forgiveness with God, not on the basis of your own goodness, but on the basis of what Christ has done. That's what grace is. Will you receive that? That is the gospel. And that provides the foundation for a real dynamic, spiritually unified marriage relationship. And spouses find it difficult, I think, sometimes to just put it out like that. And yet that is it. That is the heart of the matter that produces the kind of unity that we can really build a great life together with. Here's the point, folks. You can lead a horse to water. The saying is true. And what that means is, I wonder, are we committed to really praying for this intimate person in our life, this intimate ally in our life? We pray for them. We pray for our ability to serve them with vigor and authenticity. Are we praying that God would maybe bring other people into their life that could communicate to them in ways that I'm not able? Maybe I'm just too close. Are we praying that they would become aware of the goodness of God and the contrast with their own inner moral world? To pray for our spouse in a diligent way. To also be willing to express our honest and heartfelt desire for them and for the relationship. It's because I love you. It's because I care for you. It's because I want more for us than we've ever been able to have before that I'm asking you, consider. I'm asking you, investigate. I'm wanting you to understand that I don't want Christ to be between us. I want him to be under us, to support us, and to give us something, a basis to forgive, a spiritual power to be able to move through the hard things in life. I want to do that together with you. And that is something you need to decide that you want. And to initiate respectful conversation about matters of faith. Boy, I'm aware, and maybe it's a generational thing. I know for sure in my own parents' generation, you just don't talk about personal things like faith. Well, I see that increasingly take root in the generation that's represented here tonight. Maybe for different reasons, but it's still there. And it's very important for us to initiate. My language here is very carefully chosen. To initiate, that means I'm bringing things up. Respectful, that means I believe you're an intelligent person. I believe that you are a person with integrity that will respond. It means that I take your objections seriously, and it's a conversation, not a debate. But to initiate respectful conversation about matters of faith is very important. That's how God often works through people who are willing to stay in that relationship long enough for someone to say, okay. That was true for me. I don't know, many of you maybe have the same kind of experience. I had intimate allies in my life for years. Who were bringing up in a respectful way conversations about my faith, my lack of faith. And just that willingness for them to, in a non-threatening way, just to say, you know, maybe you haven't understood, but here's the message. And what do you think about that? Do you have an opinion here? Is there an objection? Let's talk, let's interact, let's dialogue together about that. You know, that is how the overwhelming majority of adults move toward Christ. They have someone in their life who is willing to stay in that conversation with them, as they did with me and as they have for many of you. And lastly, maybe what we're saying is, you know, you're the kind of person who needs to see what does it look like to be a man who is spiritual. You think maybe getting into Christ is a sign of weakness, is an assailing of your masculinity, that you'll become what the vast majority of men in our culture think, that religion is for women and children. And maybe you need to be introduced to some of my friends who are studly, manly guys who will kick your butt if you disagree. No, I'm just saying. Who are intelligent and who are engaged with life and who are just like you in so many respects and have really come alive spiritually through Christ. You need to meet people like that, or women, or whatever it is. And just to realize that I live my life in the marriage relationship, in the broader context of a community of faith that has huge resources that will be able to present Christ in compelling ways to people that I love and that I'm close to and that I may not be able, for whatever reason, to communicate with effectively. So this follows from Paul's own words, issues of advice. These are matters of conscience. These are things that we're going to need to wrestle with before God in those intimate relationships where we are not reading off the same page spiritually. And I can just tell you, again, by a fairly considerable base of knowledge, including the knowledge of several marriages here tonight, that it is possible and it is awesome to see God at work through a believing spouse who's doing the things that we're describing here and is able to have that delight in seeing the person that they love most come to Christ and be unified together with Him. It's beautiful, it's awesome, and that is the commitment that God is calling on us to make with one another.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.